Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and to the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today, we're looking at the history of curry. Now, we are obviously a nation of curry lovers, and curry is big business in the UK. Estimates vary, but one trade group suggests that curry houses employ 100,000 people and have annual sales of £4.2 billion. And that's not even counting supermarket sales, recipe book sales, and so on. And it's not just here in the UK. Whether you're sitting under palm trees in Abu Dhabi or on a night out in Glasgow, you're part of a global curry scene. And with this global spread comes a fascinating history, bringing together centuries of trade, immigration, colonialisation, and culinary innovation. So with me to look into the history of curry are two fabulous guests. We have Shrabani Basu, who's a journalist, frequently to be seen and heard on radio and TV, talking about Indian history and empire. And she's also a fantastic and successful author. Her many works include the book Curry, the Story of the Nation's Favourite Dish. Hello there, Shrabani.
Hello.
Very good.
It's lovely to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And we're also joined by another fantastic writer, food historian Lizzie Collingham, author of The Hungry Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World, and also Curry, A Tale of Cooks and Conquerors. Hello there, Lizzie.
Hello.
It's great to have you too. Right, let's get straight into this. I mean, you know, in the introduction there, I sort of mentioned curry houses and things like that, which is a weird way to talk about food. So let's define what we're talking about. How do you define a curry? Shrabani, can you explain it in one single sentence?
Well, it's a generic term, I think, used here to describe all Indian food. The irony, of course, is that in India, we don't go out for a curry. It doesn't happen. We go out for, you know, maybe a North Indian dish or a South Indian meal. But here in UK, everything's a curry. So put it in a pot and give it a name.
So any definition? I mean, does it really matter? Something that's a sort of looks like a stew, a sauce combined with a protein, or I mean, anything could go, really, couldn't it?
I think so. I think something that has a sauce, definitely. I mean, you wouldn't call a kebab a curry because it's a dry, you know, Sikh kebab is different. But you would, or a dosa is not a curry, but something with gravy, something with a sauce. With cooked, you know, with spices and onions, tomatoes, whatever. I think that would make a curry.
Now, early on, you've claimed this for India, haven't you? Now, that's interesting because obviously one of the famous parts of London for eating curries is Brick Lane, which is very Bangladeshi. Mm-hmm. So it, I mean, what are we talking about, the Indian subcontinent or how? I mean, any more definition that we can get from you?
Well, the thing is... The really funny thing is that the curry houses in UK are not Indian at all. They are all run by most of them, let's say 80%, are run by Bangladeshis. And they don't actually serve the food that they eat. So I'm a Bengali myself. I'm from India. But the food that Bengalis eat is fish and rice and vegetables cooked in a very different way with different tempering. And the Bangladeshis, because they had to, you know, it was a survival for them that they adapted this dish, served it, it made it so popular. And, well, they served a North Indian cuisine, a sort of adapted flavor just for the Brits.
Yeah,
but it worked.
Well, I guess, you know, you make what sells, don't you? So, Lizzie, is there any other definitions that we can lay on top of this, do you think?
Well, I think the point about it is it comes from the history of who... So it's basically the Portuguese. When the Portuguese are the first Europeans to arrive in India by sea. In 1492, Vasco da Gama arrives, and very soon the Portuguese have set up a kind of trading post in Cochin and so on. And the Portuguese then bring soldiers and numbers of them settled there as well, and they look at what the Indians are eating and they say, oh, they all seem to sort of eat broths, which the name they give to these broths is karil or kari, spelt with a K, which it seems to be words they've picked up from Kannadigan or Malayalam or so on, Indian languages that are spoken to them, and they say, what are you eating, I assume, and somebody says, oh, I'm eating curry or whatever. And I mean, I don't know whether you have anything to say about this, but I've asked many, many Indian speakers of these languages, well, what word were they saying? What were they, and nobody can agree. There's no fixed etymology, what word in an Indian language they must have heard. But anyway, they then use caril or curry to describe broths, and they're very specific about that. The Portuguese say they're the Indian broths, so like curries, gravy, sauces, and then of course the British pick up this term when they arrive in India and start to become the more dominant European power there, and caril then turns into curry, and that's why Europeans call Indian food in general curry.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Now, Shrabani, does the word curry annoy you? Is it one of those catch-alls that sort of rides over so much, you know, so much culture, history and flavour that it doesn't mean anything?
Well, it stopped annoying me now. I use the word. It's like, you know, all Indian films are called Bollywood films. And, yeah. You know, that's not the way it is. So you just get used to these generalisations. But I do want to follow up on Lizzie's. You know, the Portuguese are so interesting because we associate Indian food with red chilies and, you know, chili powder and tomatoes. And of course, it was the Portuguese, wasn't it, Lizzie? I mean, they are the ones who got chili into India.
Colombian exchange,
The heat in Indian cooking before that came from pepper, which is what the Portuguese, you know, which is what everybody came there to look for in India, trade in pepper, basically. That was gold for them. But it was, they brought in red chilies. So that changed Indian cuisine, tomatoes, all these things that we now accept as, you know, being a sort of base for Indian cooking came with the Portuguese. And so curry is something, you know, that evolves. I mean, Indian cooking has evolved over centuries. And it continues to do so, which is what makes it fascinating.
Exactly. Indian cuisine is one of those things. It absorbs all kinds of influences, pulls them in and spits them out in different forms. That's how cuisines evolve, isn't it? I mean, so, yes, the chili arrives within 30 years of the Portuguese arriving in South India. There are chilies growing wild and they work very well. They replace long pepper more than they do black pepper. Black pepper remains an important, but long pepper was annoying because it would go moldy if you tried to store it. I think it's kind of long catkin like thing, and so chilies really replace that very well. So, and I think it also has vitamin C and it grows easily, and so, and then chilies then spread slowly up the peninsula. The Marathas take on chilies, and then the Mughals say, "Oh, these horrible, fiery, chili-eating people coming." So the Mughals aren't eating chilies at that point. So they spread up and so on. And then, you know, obviously, when the British are settled and in cantonments and so on, around their European cantonments, the British cantonments, vegetable market gardens develop, which try to grow the vegetables that the British are missing. And I remember it's Kirkpatrick, who William Dalrymple writes about, who actually has a cartload of potatoes carted in over these in a war-torn sort of area because he's missing his potatoes and he wants sea potatoes to grow in his garden. So yes, those things, potatoes, cauliflower, peas, things that we think of now as quintessentially Indian, you would expect to find them in an Indian dishes and so on. Tomatoes are such a Punjabi, Bengali base. They're all brought in by Europeans.
So all the Colombian exchange again, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. So what about the concept of heat itself? Now, I mean, long pepper was used to begin with, and then chilies came in. Were curries always hot? I mean, presumably it would have been a new ingredient at some stage and probably quite expensive to use. So was fiery heat always a feature of cuisine, do you think? Certainly from, you know, from Cochin outwards, where the Portuguese landed. Shrabani, any thoughts on that?
No, it's not, heat is not central to all Indian cooking. So I come from Bengal and a lot of the dishes there are actually very mild. They just use a five spice and it's so mild, you know, and they often use a little bit of sugar as well. From Gujarat, you know, Gujarati food is also, has a lot of, they use jaggery, it's quite sweet. And up north in Kashmir, now that again was interesting because that was the Mughal influence, came from Persia, and they use apart from saffron, they use apricots and raisins. So there is a sweetness in their pulaos. So the cuisine varies. It is not just about heat. I'd say a lot of heat is focus down south.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. You know, if you go to Tamil Nadu, that's probably the hottest. I mean, you can hit that heat factor there in Chennai. You know, it's really challenging.
Yeah,
and then in Kerala and beyond, it's quite sweet curries and gentle creamy curries.
Well, in Kerala also there's very fiery stuff though, isn't there? And if you make a curry just using black pepper, you can make, which is what they would have used, you can make an extremely fiery, I've had some, extremely fiery curry just using black pepper. You don't necessarily need chilies. But it's that, don't you think it's much more that flavour range through a subtle use of spices that distinguishes all kind of various, it's you know, just putting heat on is not what most Indian cooks are trying to achieve. They're trying to achieve, you know, a melding of flavors on your palate.
Mm-hmm. And so, it always has yogurt or coconut. So if it's very hot, you're going to eat it with these accompaniments. So it reduces the heat anyway. So everything's fairly balanced.
So I mean, we're talking about capsaicin here, which is a chili, you know, that's the chili heat compound. And that's not water soluble. So you have to have lassies and things like that to then calm it down afterwards. But I wonder, did the British get that to begin with? So we're talking very much about how the British, you know, we worship the curry now. Whatever we, you know, whatever that definition we have of it, originally, why was that? Was it a hot a chili hot food that they began with? Why did it sort of seep into our consciousness?
I mean, initially, in the 17th century, when Thomas Rowe, the British English ambassador to the Mughal Empire, emperor, arrived in India, you know, he's coming from a society in England. It was quite common to use spices. Why were the English there? They'd gone because they wanted to get the spices, right, which they were importing in order to, they were trying to circumvent the Arab world and Venice. So, and they were eating a cuisine. The elite cuisine was influenced by Catalan cuisine, which was a meld between Spanish and Arab influences because the Arabs had been in charge of the Iberian Peninsula. And so that elite, very, very spicy cuisine was already very, very, they were accustomed to it. So when they go to, when Terry, Ron of Rowe's sidekicks, arrives in, he describes a chicken dish, which is a bit like a korma. He says it's very like blancmange, which was a chicken dish in Europe. So they love it because it's not particularly different or unusual. And then later on in the 18th century, when the East India Company is established and British and English, British, depends on which period you're talking about, When they settle there and work there as officials, they love the food that they're served by their Indian cooks, and they want to bring it back and they want to bring it home. It's as the British become more established in India, their cooks adapt the flavour range that they're for the food that they're cooking for them, and so then British curries tend to be much more flavoured with coriander and ginger rather than cardamom and cloves. Those are the kind of, that's the flavour palette that the British really like. And so that curries get adapted for British tastes while the British are in India.
Yeah. So Shribani, can you give us some examples of some of the early curries that the British would have eaten?
So there's descriptions by all the travellers, and these are, you know, really interesting. So they go, I mean, we have Sir Thomas Rowe. I mean, he attends these banquets because he's there as the ambassador in the court of the Mughal Emperor Jahangir. And the descriptions by, you know, are of like 50 course meals and elaborate meal settings, and the rice, which is in, you know, different colored rices, just the rice itself is in various varieties. So they are absolutely seduced by these flavors. There's no going back, you know, once you've tasted these. So there is this hankering to adapt and also to bring it back, which is why the returning East India Company officials, then they're called the Nabobs, they hanker for this food when they come back home. And that starts this journey of bottling up this magic in a curry powder, you know, in a little jar or bottle, and sending it back home. So then also housewives are creating these. So by, you know, by sort of the 19th century, there is a craze for cooking curries for housewives to show off. So it just keeps evolving. They buy them at chemists, jars of these.
Yeah, yeah.
They're advertised in the papers, Bengal hot curry, Hobson's curry, curry powder, and they'll have this man, you know, typical sort of images, a snake charmer,
exactly.
Heat. And, you know, they are absolutely marketing the Orient. So it's there, and it's, you know, exotica in a bottle. They buy these and they recreate them. Often there are recipes along with these bottles and jars, and you know, they are recreated in England.
When they first come back, they bring cooks with them quite often, so they bring recipes. And the earliest recipe for a curry that's published in 1847, but also the Duke of Portland, I think they have the earliest manuscript recipe for a curry. They are actually attempts to create an Indian dish with separate spices that you roast and then grind. Eliza Acton says, roast your cardamom, coriander on a shovel over the fire. And so on. So they do attempt to properly reproduce proper recipes, but then they start to take shortcuts, and you get Dr. Arnott's curry powder and so on in recipe books and so on. The Major General recommended to me so and so recommended to me this.
Yes,
and he recommends this combination to make the best curry, and then they take shorthand, and it becomes much more of a generic dish.
Yeah.
Which is just onions, then the curry powder, then the meat, then the... And so that it evolves over time. It isn't a straightforward... It's a process by which
absolutely.
The British constantly take shortcuts to make this what we think of now as a curry.
Well, we still take shortcuts. But there's this really amusing incident. And this is when there's the Irish potato famine. And there is the Duke of Norfolk. And he says that when a man is hungry and he has nothing else to eat, let him just have a spoonful of curry powder in water and he'll go to sleep a happy man.
Oh,
and there is outrage at this. You know, at this suggestion,
and they
call him the curry powder Duke, and then there are poems, sort of, you know, really satirical poems and sort of illustrations about this curry powder Duke, poor man. Anyway, what a suggestion, you know, in a famine, just
classic,
have curry, have a spoon of curry powder.
Yeah.
I think he deserves to be lampooned.
Yeah, quite right too. but this brings up a more important point. So we're importing Indian culture, we're bringing chefs over. Now, is this a celebration of Indian culture, or is it self-propagation of the colonial machine? You know, because we're creating this demand in the UK for these products, is this just reinforcing colonialism, or is it putting our arms around Indian culture and saying we love it? Lizzie, what do you think?
I think that curry powder is a way of making Indian food portable. It's a kind of, it's typical of the Victorians to reduce food to an industrial curry powder. To industrialize food, like they're doing that to custard. You know, they're producing custard powders and they're producing biscuits in factories and man-made, untouched by human hand. Curry powder is all of a piece with this Victorian process of processing, reducing food to an industrial formula, and then that makes Indian food that they love in India portable, and they can bring it home. And then you find one cookery book writer, I can't remember her name, I'm not sure if she's anonymous, I think she's anonymous, in 1851 says, we have made curries have now been thoroughly naturalized. We serve curry on our dinner tables. So this is an appropriation of somebody else's food, and it demonstrates that you have early on, it demonstrates that you have links to an East India Company official or East India Company family, because you've got access to these recipes and these spices. Then later on, as they become more generally available, it demonstrates that you're part of Britain, which has an Indian empire. It's not a nice, happy story of embracing Indian culture. It's celebrating your own power to rule over another country. It's not... It's not a pretty story. Yeah.
Shrabani, can you any more sort of details you can fill in on this for us?
Yeah, I think at this stage, in the early stages, it is definitely, you know, your stamp of empire. They had this whole thing. There are posters showing empire food. So the food of the empire. I mean, remember when getting a pineapple on your table was the most exotic thing.
Yeah.
So it's all part of that. It's demonstrate that, you know, we conquer that place and we can get that food here and we can serve it,
yeah.
You know. But talking about, you know, Victorian times, of course, the biggest, let's say, the influencer of her day was no less than Queen Victoria herself.
Yeah.
And of course, she had two Indian cooks. She had two Indian servants who were, well, they were meant to be table hands, sort of written about them, Abdul Karim and Muhammad Baksh. And so one day, Abdul Karim cooks her a curry. And in her journals, she pronounces it as excellent. And then she orders that a curry be cooked in the royal kitchens every day. And this is something, when I was researching this book, I had absolutely no idea that this actually happened every day. And in the archives at Osborne House, I actually found their menus. And it is there, Indian chicken curry. And what did she like? Very simple, chicken curry and dal. So nothing has changed. And they are written there, and the menu cards are produced, yeah, you know, sort of very oriental in style. And she serves these with great aplomb. So here we are, you know, empire again. Mm. She serves these to the Indian princes. So by now she has a coterie of Indian servants who are actually grinding this masala in these royal kitchens. They've taken over the kitchens, and there's elaborate descriptions of them grinding the masala, making the curries, authentic curries, not out of a bottle for Her Majesty, of course.
Righty.
So they are authentic, they're the real article, and she serves them to visiting Indian princes. She's learned a bit of Urdu, she shows off. So it's all about, it is all about really putting her case that this is the empire. She does it in the Darbar room, which has an Indian setup. She's serving her curries. And, most of them are actually really impressed. And there is this incident of the Emir of Afghanistan, and he is down for talks because there's trouble, as always. And he was in London, and he is starving because he can't get halal meat. So he couldn't eat. And then he goes down to the royal palaces. I think it was Windsor. And of course, she serves him an elaborate banquet, all halal, because obviously she has Muslim servants.
They all
cook halal meat. First time probably that, you know, an Indian, a British monarch was eating halal food. And she serves this. And he is a happy bunny. All problems are solved. He gives an elaborate gift to, you know, Abdul Karim. He knows he's the man behind all this.
Yeah.
And so it's a bit of curry diplomacy.
Right.
So,
and she was the Instagram influence of her day as well, wasn't she? You know, when she did something, everyone else went, I've got to do that because Queenie's up to it.
So absolutely. So empire and curry went together. Mm.
Yeah, Disraeli had named her Empress of India in 1877 in a calculated attempt to enlist the working classes and enlist all the classes in Britain to identify with the fact that they had an empire.
Yeah.
So this is a political move to, and that's why you have all the India exhibitions and so on. Mm-hmm. However, I must say, you know, mm-hmm, maybe people enjoyed their curries at the tables of Queen Victoria, but I have come across, the Victorians love nothing more than to put a spoonful of curry powder in with a cold meat hash to cheer it up. And I have found comments where poor Indian visitors are presented with this as though this is some delicious curry, and they look at it and think, oh my God,
curried spam.
Where are the famed chutneys and wonderful food of Lucknow? And I'm presented with this peculiar hash. So, I think. And when I've tried making some of these recipes from Victorian cookbooks, they are very weird, quite often quite bland.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't, if I were blindfolded and told to taste test, I wouldn't recognise it as some Indian food.
Coronation chicken certainly isn't, is it? But then that's a slightly
Oh, that's 1950s,
affair,
yeah.
Okay, let's think about the movement of food cultures. Now, I've eaten a fantastic curry in Tonga, great stuff in Burma and Uganda. I mean, best curry I've ever had was actually in Abu Dhabi, where huge amounts of Indian workers eating fantastic Indian food. But there are lots of examples of these these dishes moving from their birthplace and finding new homes. It's not just the British, is it, who've imported Indian food. Tell us a little bit more about that, Shravani.
Right. So it's really interesting, this, because it's the pattern of immigration, isn't it? I mean, the British are responsible for some of this because they took indentured labor to the West Indies to look after the sugar fields, Trinidad, Jamaica, which is why so large numbers of Indians went there.
Can you just explain to us what indentured labor is for anyone that doesn't know?
Indentured labor. So it's sort of one step below slavery. So they can't really, they're almost bonded labor. They're not slaves, they're not shackled, but they can't really leave. So they are taken there, they are ferried across, and they work in these sugarcane plantations. And there, of course, they're mainly from Bihar and eastern India. They carry their cuisine. So the famous author, Naipaul, V.S. Naipaul, is from Trinidad. And he talks about many of these, the big Indian society there. Mm. So a lot of the food there, you have so many dishes in Trinidad, which they use coriander powder, cumin powder, ginger, it's got all, turmeric, it's got all the Indian spices.
Yeah.
I think they're called chumuri, and there's a pumpkin curry. Then in Jamaica, you have, the famous rice and peas, goat curry, all that again, indentured labor, all the influences. And that's just the West Indies. So the Brits are responsible for that. Also Africa. So you have South Africa, you have Kenya, you have Uganda.
Uganda's an amazing Indian food cuisine, isn't it?
Exactly. So this migration that happened, they were either going there to build railroads or they were going there as traders. And wherever they went, they carried their cuisine. So there is so much Indian influence in African cuisine. And then you go to the Far East. So there again, there is this Malaysia, Singapore. It's the Tamil population that moved there. And so Malaysian curries are very spicy. They have that Tamil curry leaves and mustard flavoring and tempering, and very, very fiery. Mm. Roti canai, a very, famous Malaysian dish. That's totally Indian Malaysian influences, and so on, Singapore as well. So it just goes on. So wherever the Indians moved, they're, as with all migration patterns, when the Chinese move, they're taking their food with them. And so similarly, this is happening. So curries then spread because the Indian diaspora went all around.
So the question really about this is this appropriation or is it a celebration? And does it matter, Lizzie? I mean, this is rooted in hundreds of years ago, and yet we still think of it as an Indian food. So does it matter that we shift and change and borrow and steal?
Well, I think the Guyanese are a very interesting story for this. So the Guyana is a sugar plantation. The African slaves are replaced by Indian indentured labourers, and they're given rations, and normally the British would give sugar, flour, tea and so on, but they know that the Indian workers aren't going to that's not going to wash with them. So they have to give them rice and dal and curry stuff. And the interesting thing is they give them curry powder. Okay, so curry powder made actually quite often in Jamaica. So no Indian self-respecting cook would admit to using curry powder in their curries. Even today, I can't get most of them to admit they ever use it. But the Guyanese, of course, only really have curry powder and a bit of garam masala. And they still, Guyanese Indian descendants still cook with curry powder. So there, and there's a lovely recipe book from an Indian High Commission people coming over from India, and Guyanese curry, and there's a mutton curry, and the Guyanese one is just take curry powder and put a bit of garam masala at the end, and the Indian one, it for the High Commissioner ladies, is full of different spices, all used at different spaces. So it did, quite often if you go into the history of the dishes, if you haven't had a large post-indentured labour wave of Gujaratis selling spices like you do in South Africa or Guyana, in Fiji, then you tend to get a very basic kind of curry. It often tells the history of that particular place in the kind of curries they're cooking. Is it an appropriation? Well, obviously Indian indentured, that's just the Indian diaspora. They're taking their food with them, and they've got every right to. And of they're spreading the love of it to the nations where they make their home. I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing, is it? I mean, you know, that's how cuisines move.
That's right, yeah. Can you ever own a cuisine? It's a complex idea.
I mean, they have a story of hardship and appropriation and all that within those dishes. But if we recognise that, and I don't see anything wrong with eating other people's food, as long as you don't consider it yours.
Yeah, and absolutely. And, you know, I think both of you, your books are about celebrating what's happened there. You know, it's a very positive thing. Okay, let's get on to the concept of the format within which we eat it. So when tea and coffee first arrived in Europe, we had tea houses, coffee shops were the big thing. When curry first came here, was there an equivalent of that? And we talk about curry houses. That's a strange phrase, isn't it? A curry house rather than a curry restaurant, or, you know, we also say Indian restaurants, even though, as you said, Shrapani, it's not always Indian. But what about the environment within which we eat it? How vital or how important was that? Certainly the history of it, Shrapani.
Right. So the first curry house, Indian restaurant that was started was 1810. And it was started by this very flamboyant man called Saqi-ud-Din Muhammad. He had left Calcutta, Bihar. He was from there in India. He had left India when he was just a teenager, and he went with his Irish East India captain to Ireland. And then he got married, and then he came to London, and he decided that he was going to set up this restaurant. And it was catering to very much the nabobs of the East India Company, the returning nabobs who, you know, I spoke about earlier. So it was their hankering for curry. He called it the Hindustani Coffee House. So a bit of your coffee house as well as curry house. And it was in Portland Street. And he decorated it to the nines. So full Raj nostalgia. It was, you know, cane chairs, peacocks. He advertised it in the Times. There's an elaborate ad for returning Indian gentlemen and nawabs is how he advertises it.
I want to go there. It sounds fantastic.
Right now, all you'll see is a green plaque from Westminster Council celebrating that. So he was quite the pioneer. He wrote his travel diaries, but this restaurant folded up. It was probably too expensive. And he then went on to Brighton, and he started a shampoo sort of bathhouse where he did the Indian head massage, which is now so popular. He was doing it back then. So that's his story. He was quite a character. But what happened afterwards is also really interesting, because turn of the century, then, well, you have the big Empire Exhibition in Wembley, and one of the biggest sort of displays there is the India Pavilion. And what does the India Pavilion have? Of course, it has Indian food. It has a restaurant, first custom restaurant, not like all the others which were serving, you know, standard food from different places. This one, they insisted, would be run by Indians with proper Indian chefs, you know, who had arrived from India. So that was, and it was run by a person called Edward Palmer. He was descended from English and Mughal heritage, and he loved Indian food. He used to write about Indian food, and he was given charge of running this restaurant. And so for the first time, people could actually go out there. Ordinary people who had bought a ticket for the Empire Exhibition could go there and sit and order a curry, because you couldn't really do that before. And the queues were enormous. They would snake around the block. It was the biggest attraction. And so by the end of, you know, by 1925, he was doing 200 curries a day. So of course that was, you know, that set him going. And then what did he start? A restaurant bang on Regent Street, Veeraswamy, which still exists today, of course, under different management, but it is the oldest surviving Indian restaurant, which makes it really interesting, because 1926,
really exciting,
Edward Palmer sets up Veeraswamy. So this goes on. But at this stage, it's very fancy. We are nowhere near the high street curry houses. That is going to happen in the 60s, you know, and then 70s with the Bangladeshis arriving, then the Idi Amin expelling all the Indians, or the Ugandan Asians arriving, but mainly the Bangladeshis who set up all these curry houses. So all again catering to Raj nostalgia. They're called the Viceroy or the Gurkha or the Everest, and they have these names, they have this flock wallpaper, they have these white napkins and tablecloths and liveried waiters. And of course, they get their heads kicked in because, you know, they're the only ones serving. So that bit then gets quite dark. But at the same time, these are your pioneers who are starting these cheap and cheerful curry houses. They're going to give you your food when the pubs have closed. They'll give you your beer. They'll give you your, you know, red vindaloo. And they're just catering to the masses. But that's how it started.
So Lizzie, can you just talk us through that big evolution? So from the special and the refined concept to the sort of the mass market. Is that a success for curry, or is that a decline?
One of the things I want to say about the Hindustani Coffee House, my favourite thing about it is that they had a separate hookah smoking room, and he advertises, that he imports the tobacco and the spices and mixes it there, and you can have an authentic hookah smoking experience in your restaurant after you've had your lovely curry. So I really love that. I would love to have been able to go to that. I think the hookah smoking room attracts me possibly even more than the curries. In terms of the movement, so you get these, you get Viraswamis, of course, and then there's a few other people who set up, Bahadur brothers come over and set up a swanky Indian restaurant chain. And then, of course, what you get is a lot of Silettis are working in the engine rooms of ships, which is a horrible job. So they're the traditionally boatmen, so that's why they end up on the boats. They end up in the engine rooms. They jump ship because that's horrible, horrible position to be in. Absolutely.
I would.
And so you get little restaurants in port towns, London and New York and so on, setting up catering to those men who've said. So when I was a student, my tutor took me to one of these little restaurants that was a leftover from one of these restaurants which had catered purely to Sileti men who'd jumped ship, and it was one of the best meals I've ever had. That's a long time ago now, obviously gone now. But also, so a lot of these men, they've jumped ship, they're looking for employment, so they go into the catering trade, and they go through these Indian restaurants and learn and see what they're serving, and they wash up or peel potatoes and so on, and look. And so they've seen, okay, this is the kind of food, this Anglo-Indian weird Mughal Punjabi cuisine that's on the menu in the 1920s and 1930s, and so they see that, and 40s by now, and then they save up enough money. A lot of these men, you know, they're living in houses, they're sharing a bed or a room with eight other people or whatever, and they save up enough money and they buy bombed out fish and chip shops, little cafes. They look where a Chinese takeaway is because they know that then there's going to be a good market for their food, and they set up a little shop. Mm-hmm. They serve fish and chips and they serve rice and curry and so on, and that's how they get started. And then eventually they set up the curry houses. They turn them into these Raj Nostalgia flock wallpapered little restaurants that I remember so strongly from when I was a student, which are kind of disappearing now, aren't they? It's kind of sad. So is that an appropriation? Well, I think
it's an appropriation. Is it a decline, or is it success, or is it failure?
I don't know. I mean,
or is it neither?
What's your remit then for a success or failure? I mean, if for these men, it provides them a good living and a way of making a living in Britain and establishing themselves. Their families then go on, so their kids often don't want to work as waiters in the restaurant, go on, get an education and go off and, you know, successfully British Asian and so on. So, I mean, that's a success. I certainly loved those curries when I was a student and so on. So it introduces British people to other flavours, you know, along with Italian restaurants and travel and so on. It's not what, I mean, often the waiters look at what they're serving and they don't recognise it as Indian food. But it's authentic in terms of the food has its own history. There's a reason why it's like that.
In its own world. Yes, so, absolutely.
You know, I don't think I would say it's a failure.
Okay. So, Shrabali, I guess what I'm getting at is that it's difficult now for an Indian restaurant to or an Asian Indian subcontinent restaurant to make refined food and charge a lot of money for it. There are restaurants that do it and do it well, and I think things are changing. But I think for a long time it was expected that if you ate Indian food with various different curry flavors that we're talking about, you know, based on cardamom and spices and things, that you would be spending a small amount of money.
It was, definitely. The brand was cheap and cheerful, and that's what they served. Yeah. But, you know, when we talk about success failure, I think it was their success story. They were pioneers. And the fancy Indian restaurants that you have now, these were the guys who created this demand. Whatever they served up, people loved it. It became sandwich fillings, pizza toppings, chilled super, you know, you had these supermarket curry kings created out of these guys because they were marketing them in the supermarkets after that. People wanted take it home, put it in the microwave, you know, pink cuisine as they called it. So they laid the foundation. So I think whatever they served up, I mean, I'm you know, I came here in the late 80s and I was horrified and I would ask them why are you doing this? I would speak to them in Bengali and they would say it's for them, we make it different.
That's what they want, we'll make it for them. Absolutely.
We give it to them. And absolutely, fair enough. This is their livelihood. This is what has made them, you know, their money and got them through hard times. Yeah. And also they were really many of them faced a lot of racism. So yeah, they absolutely. Took it. They just quietly took it, which I find really moving because, you know, they would come after the pubs had closed and demand their vindaloos and demand their beers, and these guys would serve them and take it. So they laid the foundations. All the posh Indian restaurants you see now, which are run by authentic, you know, sort of hired from the five-star restaurants of India, and they serve really good food. I must say some of the best Indian food is now available in London as well. So it is authentic, it is very well made, and they themselves acknowledge that if it wasn't for these curry houses, these Bangladeshi cooks who took this on, cooked a cuisine that is not their own and served it, you know, it is because of them. So I think it's their success story.
Okay. Well, I think
I would qualify it as their success. And hats off to them for braving it, really, doing this.
Now, I think also something that's interesting about going out for a curry, so the classic, you know, going out to a curry house, is about the experience. Now, the most extraordinary curry I've ever had was not about the taste, it was about the experience. So I went to the Onam Festival in Kerala, you know, where free food is given in everywhere, just so many different places, local temples and everything. There was just a huge festival of giving, and the food itself was interesting. It's classic Keralan food with using curry leaves, and you know, it was quite sweet and creamy and delicious. But what was really interesting was the way it was eaten. You know, lots of people eating together, class and status and wealth, it didn't matter. Everyone would go along and sit down and eat these meals that were provided free of charge, and it felt like an important collective experience. Now, going down Brick Lane isn't the same as that, but there is still this sense that it is a team event. You know, when I go out with my friends for a curry, it's that collective experience. What's going on there? I mean, where does that, is that about the way it's served, about the nature of the curry, or is it just something that has grown up because it became a cheap food? Lizzie, have you got any views on this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that if you go and eat at a, if you're in, well, lucky enough to be invited to an Indian home, and there's, you know, Auntie so-and-so is bringing her best dal, and so-and-so is bringing her dish. Everybody has, in a family, tends to have a particular dish that they cook very well. You know, I don't think it is entirely an Indian thing, because also, you know, when I go to my parents-in-law for Café and Kuchen in Germany, it's sort of so-and-so, Elizabeth's bringing her this kind of torten, and that one is bringing her Kwaksana Kuchen and so on. So, but it's something about the way that, you know, there's a pride in mastering a particular dish, and then you present that, and it's a collectively then enjoyed by everybody, and everybody puts it together. It's a buffet food, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's a way, I think that it does create a kind of lovely, sociable, way of bonding with other people, with their, and there's a, you know, in the Indian diaspora, many people have diasporas, but it's the Indian diaspora is really marked in its determination to hold on to its food culture. Yeah. So you'll find, I find quite often, I've talked to Africans or so on, they'll say, ah, yes, well, I eat plantain on a Sunday. But they wouldn't, you know, hold on to their food as an everyday food. But maybe because Indian food is so absolutely, why wouldn't you? That's what you eat every day in an Indian diaspora home, mostly. Yeah. And I think there is something special about that. And, you know, it does bring people into a kind of buffet experience.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, Shrabani, the other hugely important element to eating Indian food in India, I think, is the way that you touch it. Now, certainly in the Onam feast, the idea that you might have a knife and fork is insane. You grab it and you roll it into a ball, you scoop up your rice, and then you push it into your mouth using your thumb, which I had to be taught. I watched it and I couldn't see how people were really doing it. I just got this stuff all over the place. But the act of doing this, I think, is central to a different culinary experience. I tried to do this, and we had an Onam feast in my house. It was about 12 people. I banned cutlery from the table, and I thought everyone would have a riot, and it would be messy, and that everyone would love it, and especially the kids, because it was so messy. They hated it. They couldn't understand not eating with knives and forks. It really freaked them out. But it is a different experience, isn't it? Tell us a little bit, how important is the tactile nature of eating with your fingers?
Yep, certain foods. I mean, there is no other way to eat it. If I've got, river fish on my plate, which is from Bangladesh in India, and it is hilsa, which is very bony, the only way I can clean that and eat it properly is if I go in with my fingers. I've got.
If you try and do that with a knife and fork, it's just going to be chaos.
Yeah, it's dangerous. I mean, you just choke on some bones probably. Yeah. So there are some foods that you absolutely have to eat. Get in with your fingers. Roti. I mean, chapati, dal. How else do you eat it? Can you eat a dosa with a knife and fork? I mean, you can't really. So it's out of question. Pakoras. You know, you just pick them up and pop them in your mouth. So yeah, certain things.
And do you eat with a knife and fork at home?
Who, you asking me?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. And not Indian food. No. Even my daughters get it with their fingers. Yeah, no. But I had to teach them. It's a fine art, as you say. You know, you can't get messy. So you've got to just use the tips of three fingers and not have it all over you. So I had to teach them how to eat it properly, cleanly, you know, so that you're not making a mess. So that's quite important.
A friend of mine told me that his grandfather taught him how to eat. He was the first Dalit minister in Nehru's cabinet, and he was extremely strict that if you mustn't get the gravy above the first knuckles of your fingers.
Must have offended
you can,
so many
you can
people.
Stay dirty below that, but above, and then you're sort of a messy eater.
Yes. So it has to be the tips, just the fingertips with which you eat.
Okay,
so you keep it clean.
All right, we've got to stop this. We're running out of time. We've so run out of time because we've been yakking away about these fascinating subjects with you two amazing people. Now, the last question I've got for one is for both of you, basically. Mm-hmm. This is a podcast aimed very much at the food industry. There are people listening to this who will be making millions and millions of pounds by making food. What is the food industry missing in Indian food? Is there something that, you know, is there a way of somebody making a new product that is going to be just absolutely off the charts? Is there a product? Is there a way of marketing it? Are we missing an audience that might want a particular type of food? Any top tip for something that the food industry hasn't quite nailed yet? Shrabani.
Ooh, that's something to think about. Now, I am hopeless at making rotis and puris. I just can't do anything that needs kneading. So if somebody, and I don't really like the ready-made packets that you get. They're really no good. So if somebody mastered that and made maybe little puris, because I've had them in Canada, I know that in Montreal, my uncle got these packets where they've actually had these puris. You could just dip them there, frozen packs, and you could make pretty good puris. Now, if somebody made that, I would love that because I love puris. Okay. You know, the things that we really struggle to make at home. I mean, you know, it's things like that. And also fish. I don't think they really know how to cook fish Indian style. So Bengalis eat a lot of fish. We use mustard. They just can't do that here. So they need some authentic cooks to come in and, you know, make it for them with the mustard paste and the green chili and, you know, the real stuff that goes into it. So they need to master those dishes, maybe, because it's different.
Just your
cuisine.
Description of it makes me want to eat it. So food industry, pull your finger out. Come on. You've got to get some of this. Okay. Lizzie, anything that we've missed? I mean, what about some of the sort of tangential aspects of this? You know, we've had mango chutney and brinjal pickle and things like that. And anything that the food industry hasn't quite nailed yet?
Oh, I'm really a bad person to ask this question. I mean, one thing that I really, because I don't really buy pastes or curries or something. I make it myself from scratch at home. One thing I'm really frustrated by is that it's really hard to get fresh curry leaves. So if you want to cook beautiful Kerala fish dishes, you need the curry leaves. And it's really hard to, I mean, I appreciate
them. I grow them.
Yeah.
But I grow them on my kitchen window. It's a big plant.
Excellent. You have to give me some tips how to grow them, because I've never successfully managed to grow them. So, yes, if I could get those easily. I
can get dried ones, can't you? But they're rubbish.
No, rubbish. They don't work.
They don't have the same flavour. You have to get fresh curry leaves.
Yeah, and fresh curry leaves.
The only way to do it is to grow it.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you heard it here first. Maybe, and you know what? I would buy if they had the little pots of thyme and coriander. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If they had little pots of curry leaves, that would.
I would buy those.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely. That's the one. There you go, food industry. That's your tip for the top. Okay, we've got to end it there. We've just gone on far too long, but that has been absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for your knowledge and your depth of knowledge and the way that you give it with such good grace. Shrabani Basu and Lizzie Collingham, thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to the Food Matters Live podcast on your preferred platform. And if you've got a moment, why not leave us a review? Thank you so much for listening.